Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening this morning. Today on the show, we have two of our group of folks that stop by here every month. We don't usually have them on the same day. Same thing actually happened last month, where we had to rearrange our schedule a little bit because we didn't want an entire month to go without seeing these folks, so they both ended up on the same day. And same thing has happened this time around. In the first part of the program, we'll be doing our monthly show on women's health with Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist. She teaches at the U of I Med School, and once a month on a Monday, she's here, and we talk about things that are new in her field, and she also answers questions. She's been a little bit delayed here, but in a moment or two, I'm sure she'll be here and we'll get things rolling just as we usually do. In the second part of the program today, we'll be doing another one of these things that we do every month. It's usually in the 10 o'clock hour, but it is always on a Monday, and that's our show on home maintenance. Hank Spies will be here from the Spies Home Inspection Service. And if you've heard the show, you know that he knows an awful lot about just about everything that goes into the single-family home. So maybe you're having problems with water in the basement or some other question that has to do with gutters or roofing, insulation, attics, basements, windows, doors, siding, just about anything that goes into the single-family home. So if you're having some kind of problem, you need to have a little bit of advice, you can give us a call, and Hank will do his best to help you out. That will be in our number two. So in either case, we're certainly looking for your calls this morning, and all you have to do to be a part of the conversation is to give us a call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call is 333-9455. Also, we do have that toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL. And toll-free, 800-222-WILO. Those are the numbers. And our guest here in this first part of the show is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She's obstetrician and gynecologist. She is here on the program every month, and we talk about women's health and give you the opportunity to call in and ask questions. So whatever's on your mind, as long as it deals with her area of practice, and we've talked about a lot of different things on the show, I'm sure she will do her best to give you an answer. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, good morning. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Glad to have you here.
Thank you.
Usually we start out by talking about some things that are new, could be something that was in the news, or maybe can be something that's being discussed among doctors, but maybe hasn't made big news. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I thought we would start by talking about cervical dysplasia, which is, of course, what we're looking for when we test a pap smear. And there is a tremendous amount of research and development in this area. A few years back, I think in the early 90s, we introduced the Bethesda system. So it was a new type of grading of pap smears. And they're just now going to be releasing an even updated version of the Bethesda system. So we're going to really hear a lot about this very, very soon. But the challenge for physicians has been what to do about precancerous changes, because we, of course, want to prevent cancer, and we're doing a pretty good job of that. We find literally hundreds of thousands of cases of precancerous change, but very few cases each year, 5,000 to 7,000 cases each year, actually go on to become invasive cancer. And in fact, even cases of moderate and in some cases more severe dysplasia, characterized by calling it carcinoma in situ, actually 70% of these cases resolve. And I think we've talked a little bit about that before. But the trick is which women are going to persist in their disease, which women are going to go on to develop invasive cancer, and which women are going to resolve. So there's been a couple of different areas of research, and I think last year I talked about the development of vaccines, and that's still a very active area of research. And we were participating in a vaccination trial looking at healthy women, women with completely normal pap smear, and women who had actually been exposed to human papillomavirus that we think is a very important cause of cervical cancer. And we've continued to work on some vaccine development with some companies that are doing that. But also now there's a new thinking. We've had such success in treating warts, actual genital warts, which are also caused by human papillomavirus, different strains, by enhancing the patient's own immune system and actually having a cream that doesn't actually treat the wart, but it just enhances the woman's immune system to fight off the wart. So now we're looking at trying to put that technology to use to treat cervical dysplasias and using immune treatments to see if we can cause some of the precancerous changes to resolve. So that's probably the most exciting thing that I'm involved with right now. And we're looking at women with moderate to severe dysplasia and who are willing to actually be followed for a period of 6 months, and some of the women will be given various treatments to hopefully help resolve this process. And then at the end of 6 months, the women will get treated with standard therapy, which has always been cervical surgery. And what the hope is, eventually, standard therapy will be medical, not removing part of a young woman's cervix, because many women have this in their late teen, early 20s.
It's interesting that this gets into an area that I know in medical research is growing. That is the role that viruses play in disease. And I think that we're coming to appreciate that perhaps in diseases where we would not expect there to be a viral role, perhaps even things like cancer, heart disease, maybe Alzheimer's disease, all sorts of things. Researchers are starting to think, well, maybe not in all cases, but in some cases, in some of these diseases, maybe there's a virus at work. And as you say, we know that the human papillomavirus, we think, is important in some cervical cancer. Would there also be other causes as well? So it's not, we don't think it's
absolutely
all viral.
It's probably not sufficient alone to have just a human papillomavirus infection, and that's probably the key. Something else has to go on. We like to point out these immune causes because, for instance, in smokers, it's just much more likely that they will have persistent disease or more advanced disease, and the same tars and nicotines that accumulate in your lungs can actually accumulate in your cervical mucus if you're a smoker. Those byproducts of cigarette smoke go throughout an individual's body if they smoke enough. So that may be a cofactor. Maybe other viruses that we don't even know about are cofactors. We used to think the herpes virus was a cofactor. Then they thought maybe it wasn't. And then it had a brief flurry that maybe, yes, in fact, it was involved in some cases. So we're really not sure about the herpes virus as being a cofactor. But we definitely know that there's cofactors involved. And some of the cofactors may strictly be a person's own genetic makeup and their ability to fight off precancerous and cancerous type changes.
Mm-hmm. Since we know that this is human papillomavirus is sexually transmitted, has anybody ever proposed that maybe we ought to be testing men, maybe testing everybody to see if they have that virus and then going after that?
Well, we know if we do a lot of testing, we're going to get a lot of positive tests. We think that there may be 20 to 40 million Americans running around with a positive test. And the issue isn't so much can you identify everybody with a positive test, but what in fact would that positive test mean? For men, it's a lot harder to check for the virus. You can do cultures of the urethra, but they don't test out as often positive, and there's certainly no recommendation for what you do with the result. So that's a little bit problematic. There is a big push to get more individuals tested for the human papillomavirus. They can do that test on Pap smear or with a Pap smear type of test. The problem is it's expensive. I charge $200 in my office for that test, and most insurance companies don't cover it. However, if you look at the positive side, if you test negative for that, you can be treated a little bit less aggressively, even if you have a slightly abnormal Pap smear. Whereas if you test positive for the high-risk viruses, maybe, yes, you do need to go on and spend the money for more complicated tests like colposcopy. And that's another reason why I do enjoy participating in clinical trials, because it can bring women tests and treatments that they have no way of obtaining, because so much only insurance only usually covers traditional care.
Well, and In how many cases do doctors, if you have a woman who has an abnormal pap smear, do you then routinely test for the human papillomavirus, or is that something that it's up to individual doctors if
probably they want to? Nationwide, almost no one is testing for this. It's just now catching on. I've actually, because I was involved with these trials and I had access to some of these tests, I've been doing these kinds of tests for a number of years. But only clinically, I've been doing it in some of my patients for the past 6 months to a year. And like I say, it takes a lot of thinking and individual talking about an individual's case to make a decision about whether you're going to get this test because it's so expensive. And there's a little bit of controversy about what you should do with the result. So there's two big issues there. But for the Ask Us pap smear, the pap smear that's not truly characterized on your report as normal and not truly characterized on your report as abnormal, it can be invaluable.
We're talking this morning about women's health. It's something we do every month here on Focus 580 on a Monday. And our guest is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has a practice here in our area. She also teaches at U of I Med School. And she's the person who's here to answer your questions. If there's something that's on your mind that you'd like to call in and talk with her, you're certainly welcome to do that. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana folks. Toll free, 800-222-9455.
So I was going to say, just in conclusion about this topic, that if there are women who are over 18 who have a moderate dysplasia on a biopsy and would like to talk about alternative therapy, we're looking for you if you live in our area. I know many of you don't. I thought we'd talk a little bit about postpartum depression. I got a lot of calls last week about it. So maybe everybody's gotten their questions answered. There was another Newswire story about the use of estrogen as a possible therapy for postpartum depression to bridge the severe hormonal changes that go on from the time a woman's pregnant to the time she births and passes her placenta and her estrogen levels absolutely plummet. And I think that that may in fact be a good treatment for individuals that are mildly depressed, but probably will not begin to tackle some of these severe cases.
Yeah, I was thinking about that myself, and as you say, it may be on people's minds because we had the story that was in the news, a rather sad story about a woman who apparently was suffering postpartum depression and she killed her children. And actually, Dr. Bocek was here on the show last week on Thursday. He, for people who are not keeping score at home, he's a pediatrician. He's on the show every month. We talk about children's health. And someone called in and just asked the question, well, who of the healthcare professions and the people that a woman might be likely to encounter, who is it that really is in screening, or maybe even a less formal sense, sort of watching out for those sorts of signs?
And he said, what did he say?
Well, he said, you know, he had to admit that probably he is really concentrating on the baby, and that he's not paying as much attention as, you know, maybe he should to the parents. He says, well, I mean, of course you do engage the parents in a little conversation. You know, how's everything going? But, you know, he says, well, he's a pediatrician, so he's really focusing on the baby.
Well, I got asked that same question when I was doing a different interview last week, and I really feel that obstetricians, gynecologists feel that it is their role to screen for that. I feel that midwives who do births and family practitioners who do births feel that it is their role to screen for postpartum depression. But if you look at what's really going on out there in the society, we may be looking for trends during pregnancy. There are things that we look for, and there are now some popular scales, you know, answer these few questions and we'll give you a score, and that may trigger us to have higher suspicion for some patients. So we're doing that. We're certainly talking to patients when they're in the hospital, but that can be 24 to 48 hours. And many cases will certainly not present that quickly. And then the next encounter for most healthy women, they have a C-section, could be in a week, and then at 6-week checkup. But most people do not have a C-section, so that, in fact, the next encounter 6 weeks later, and severe postpartum depression often will have an onset within that first week or within that first month. So absolutely, there is a gap there. Now, what I said in my interview was that actually the pediatrician may actually see mom those couple of times in between. And Dr. Bocek may, in fact, not be giving himself enough credit, because I do think that if you presented him with a case of an infant that wasn't thriving, that one of the things on his mind would be, what's going on between mom and baby? Is mom properly bonding? Is mom properly coping? And I think that is probably true. We do a lot of follow-up phone calls to our patients, both as a program instituted by hospitals where the patients deliver and usually within gynecologists, obstetricians' offices. And so I think those phone calls do touch base on those same kinds of issues. But the fragmented and short nature of most obstetrical care probably does not lend itself to picking up as many cases as we could. Mm-hmm.
It seems to be the case. We at least understand that what's going on here is that hormonal changes as a result of the pregnancy and the birth are having this profound effect on mood. But having said that, do we really know what it is that's going on?
Absolutely not, because if you take 100 women with postpartum depression and 100 women with none, you test their hormones, they're about the same. You may have individual differences, but you'll have probably about the same span in between the different groups. There are a couple of hormonal abnormalities. Hypothyroidism, if a woman actually becomes hypothyroid, or some other kind of endocrine abnormality, and there are a few that are associated particularly with birthing. If, in fact, the woman lost a lot of blood, there are other conditions. If she's become anemic, there are things that can exacerbate the feelings of normal postpartum depression. But in terms of exactly what the trigger might be, we don't know yet. Mm.
And if you do a medical history, do you find that these women have had measurable depression before, or would you have looked at them and said, we would have really no reason to suspect that this woman
would be prone to depression? Well, good question. You know, a lot of people don't have extensive medical backgrounds. Say they had a couple of school physicals and they were pretty healthy, and maybe a couple of pap smears and boom, they're pregnant. So if you actually look at populations where they were fairly well screened for depression, or if you specifically look at populations where the patients were treated for depression, yes, they statistically are more likely to have postpartum depression. But in so much of our society still, depression or psychological infirmities of any kind are not well thought of and not well talked about within families and even within some medical settings. I think sometimes that history is relatively well hidden. But if you look at other factors, say socioeconomic stresses or single mom, that sort of thing, those stressors also seem to precipitate as often as a history of depression. Mm.
Is it likely that if a woman experiences this once in subsequent pregnancies, that we would want to be more observant, and that she'd be more likely, if she had it once, she'd have it again?
Well, absolutely. If you've had it before, practitioners are definitely more observant. And of course, there's a whole new trend of treating pregnant women and breastfeeding women with antidepressants. And we don't have a lot of information, but medications like Prozac and Zoloft and some of their cousin medications that are used in the treatment of depression have actually been safely instituted once you get past stages of fetal development. And some patients have even taken those medicines through those stages. And if you actually treat depression itself, you probably are going to do better with this group of patients.
If you're breastfeeding, can you use these medications?
You can. They don't cross over very much into breast milk, and many women do safely take these, and more of the population. Mm.
So with treatment, what can you expect for how long it would take for this to resolve?
Well, they say that it can take 6 months to a year without treatment. So hopefully with treatment, it would significantly shorten up that time frame. But, of course, it depends how quick was the identification, how severe was the depression, was the treatment appropriate, was she able to tolerate the medicine, is she taking the medicine. Some mm-hmm. breastfeeding moms listen to all the information. They go home and put the medicine on the shelf. So don't feel comfortable taking it. And I can understand that. But so there are so many factors. But hopefully it would resolve in much shorter time frame.
This morning here on Focus 580, our guest, Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She's with us each month. On a Monday, we talk about women's health. We're getting close here to the midpoint of the program. And if you have questions, you should certainly call in and talk with her. It can be about the things that we've discussed so far, but can be anything else that she deals with in her practice. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana, any place the signal will travel, 800-222-9455.
We talk a lot about using birth control pills to prevent ovarian cancer, but there's a new study out that confirms some older research that was kind of questioned that says actually getting a tubal ligation reduces your risk of having ovarian cancer, which is pretty interesting. Nobody really knows why this may be. There are some theories. We think that some of the ovary's blood supply may in fact come from blood vessels that are near the fallopian tube that would be cut off if, in fact, you get a tubal ligation. So we don't really understand what the cause may be, but an interesting study now out of England that actually even looked at women who were high risk for ovarian cancer, women who have the breast cancer gene, BRCA1, that we've talked about, or BRCA2 that we've talked about before as a possible genetic cause of some breast cancers and some ovarian cancers. Those women who underwent tubal ligation were about less than half as likely to develop ovarian cancer. It's not quite as protective as birth control pills because we feel that birth control pill use actually could eliminate about 80% of all cases of ovarian cancer. But it's an interesting thought and might be something that women considering going off their pills and having a tubal ligation want to talk about with their healthcare providers.
We have a caller here, someone who's calling on cell phone. So we'll get right to him on our line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, I have a question. My mother's in the hospital and she has blood in her stools and it was a disease or a virus called C. diff or something like that. Could you discuss that?
I'm not sure that I'm familiar with any information that would help you too much other than I know that it's been talked about, and I'm not sure that they have any actual treatments for it. It's probably going to be something that you're going to have to sit down with her physician and sit there with your notepad and ask your questions.
Okay, I never heard of the virus or whatever. Unique. Thank you, now.
Okay, I'm sorry we can't do better than that. Other questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Something I was going to ask you about, it just in the process of looking around, I came across some information about somebody did a survey and asked women about what they think are the most serious sorts of health threats that they face, threats to their health. And one of the surprising things was that women apparently are much more concerned about the possibility of cancer than they are heart disease, when in fact it's really the other way around. That is heart disease is potentially a much more serious problem than is cancer. And that there are probably a number of things that you can do to try to make your heart healthier, good diet, exercise, all that kind of stuff that apparently women are not really thinking about, because perhaps still we think of heart disease as a men's disease and not so much as a woman's disease.
It's so true. And we've known this for at least 10 years, and we haven't really made a whole lot of progress. I've seen some surveys that were exactly what you're talking about that were done about 20 years ago, and some that were done 10 years ago, and some that were just done in the past couple of years. And there's been a little bit more awareness in the public about women and heart disease. Of course, now that we have obesity is such a huge issue in the United States that actually our risks of heart disease have really started to dramatically increase because of the increased numbers of obese individuals who then in turn either have diabetes, which then also can compromise your heart, or other conditions such as arthritic conditions, which can compromise the amount of exercise you get, which then in turn increases your risk for heart disease. I think one of the problems was that if you look at the age-related rates in women and men prior to age 50, the male risk is much greater than the female risk. Mm-hmm. And we attribute that to our premenopausal status having estrogen. May not be the sole cause, but it sure looks like that's a major contributor. After menopause, if you do not supplement a female with hormones, her rate of heart disease quickly jumps to actually catch up to men in the next 5 to 10 years. And then, depending on what's going on with her case, she may actually have experience a statistically higher risk of heart disease than males that are in their 70s and 80s. So the fact that women live longer, actually, they are more likely to live to an age where heart disease is a factor. So it's a very important question, and it's absolutely something that physicians probably haven't done a good enough job in informing their patients about what their real risks are, and then in turn, how to reduce those risks.
Mm-hmm. Well, if a woman pre-menopause does all those things that we all know, you know, it's the things we know we should be doing, but maybe we're not, really does get some regular exercise, watches blood cholesterol, has a relatively healthy diet, try to keep down the fat, don't smoke cigarettes, you know, those sorts of things that that will increase your risk of heart disease. And if you try to sort of do all the good things, what happens then? Past menopause, when you start making comparisons between men and women, if you start out with women that are healthy, are they going to look
well,
like?
Well, if you look at when you institute the intervention, the earlier you institute it, the greater the percentage of heart disease you prevent. So that if women start doing this in their 20s and keep going, they're also unlikely to have some of these problems. But if they first institute these good practices in their 40s, there's just a little bit less impact. By then, some of the cardiovascular risk factors have already set up. If you've had a high-fat diet for, you know, 30 years and then 10 years of a good diet, only so much of that arterial disease is going to be reversed, maybe a little bit. So a lot depends on that. It also turns out to probably be more subtle than even some of our basic strategies that you're mentioning, cholesterol lowering and exercise and not to smoke. Certainly those are the basic strategies. But some of our clotting factors, some of our, like our folic acid levels, which you can measure by measuring homocysteine in the blood, other things like vascular adhesion molecules, the actual size of your cholesterol particles, all of these things probably factor in as much as anything else, the amount of inflammation in your blood as measured by cardio-C-reactive protein. So you can probably even more fine-tune these preventive strategies early on, and that will even further reduce your chance of heart disease.
Let's talk with another caller here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I think what you're talking about, both in terms of pap smears and women's heart incidence of heart attack, is fascinating. And by the way, thank you for always being on the show here. My question for the pap smear, and then I have one about how to read the tests that have to do with women's heart attacks. I read a couple of years ago that the problem was not that the pap smears weren't being done, but that they weren't being read very carefully. And so I'm wondering if that has improved. There was a, I don't know, big scandal, I don't know, 8-10 years ago maybe, about the fact that people didn't even read carefully the pap smears. So how in the world would they ever be able to report them? So can you comment on that? Is there an improved reading process?
Oh, absolutely. Well, when that came out, one of the problems was is there really weren't regulations about, for instance, exactly what your background training should be and exactly what equipment you should be using and exactly how many pap smears you should read. So it kind of came out that it turns out that, you know, just like when you're following a recipe, if you read slowly, you're gonna not forget that teaspoon of salt. And same with looking at a pap smear. If you spend more time looking at a pap smear, you're more likely to see something that is abnormal. So that what they did that made all the difference in the world is they set restrictions on how many pap smears an individual could read in one day. And once they did that, it naturally fell to a slower pace, and the readouts did improve. But it's even gone another leap forward. So things have been very stable in terms of pap smear readouts for a long time. But you have to remember, it has been in the past a human looking at a cell and making a judgment. Is this cell normal or abnormal? It's like an art expert looking at a painting and saying, is this painting good enough to be truly expert or not? You know, some of the fine-tuning things that are important in whether or not it's going to be called out as cancerous or not cancerous. Now we've gone a couple of steps further. First of all, we've redesigned this pap smear slide. Well, I should say we, because all of you out there are probably not getting the same kind of pap smear. But it turns out that if we prepare a pap smear in liquid, that we can do a better job. So what we used to do is take either a Q-tip or a brush or a spatula, wooden device, and basically take some of the mucus off the cervix and scrape a few cells with it and smear that on a slide. But now we take that specimen and swish it in fluid. And basically a very sophisticated machine makes what they call a monolayer of cells. So they get rid of all the junk and they just lay cells out one after another. So instead of being able to look at a slide and maybe some of the cells were heaped up on each other and you had to almost read through a cell to see if there was something abnormal, or look at a cell with a different kind of background. It's like if you take, say, something and put a white sheet under it and maybe it has a green outline versus a green sheet under it, you might not see the subtle differences. And it's the same sort of thing. So just by changing the technology, we were able to see better. So we've improved our pickup rate of slide abnormalities. Now, probably about 65-70% of physicians and about the same amount of insurance companies pay for these newer pap smear technologies. So that if you want the best pap, some sort of liquid base. Then beyond that, they're starting to develop some other, and I won't be able to cover all the different things they do to make sure they get a good pap smear, but the next big generation is trying to teach machines to read out certain basic abnormalities so that either in a reread fashion, so in other words, they screen out some that they read, or as a primary readout, different technologies are being worked on. And that's probably going to never replace 100% the humans, but it will definitely improve what they can do. And the machine can run all night long, unlike some of the humans. So that will definitely improve things and probably bring down the cost. Well, hopefully. I know in medicine we don't bring down the cost of pretty much anything. We just maybe slow down the rise of the cost. But those are the kinds of things. And also, usually most labs have internal policies of rereading out a certain percentage of their pap smears to make sure that they're not unduly missing. And one of the reasons in the United States we recommend yearly PAPs is because we recognize not every pap smear is going to be accurate, but if you go in every year, you're less likely to let something get far beyond where it should.
I remember, and I haven't read the newspapers, you know, about this for many years, but at one time it said that they would put a whole bunch of slides together and look at many at the same time, and only if they could find one pap smear that said, a possible cancerous, then they went back and looked at all the other slides. Is that still being done?
Oh, no. They read one slide at a time. And even when those stories surfaced, I don't think all labs did that. I think the minority of labs ever did anything similar to that.
Good. Well, that's reassuring. I have a similar question about the cholesterol testing that you were just talking about. Do all physicians do those minute tweaking out tests that you said are possible to do?
No. And like everything else, it comes down to a consultation between you and your healthcare practitioner and deciding what are you looking for and how likely do you want to find something that's abnormal and what costs are you willing to incur to pick up what percentage of abnormalities. And that's where all of this is kind of being worked out. I mean, there are these longevity type doctors or anti-aging type doctors who really, they look at everything from antioxidant levels and all kinds of exotic things that I'm not involved with testing, and I haven't even followed that closely in terms of the literature. But you're right, not everybody does that, but many doctors have access to many different tests, and what's important is to sit down with your physician and say, okay, well, what's available and what tests do we want to do, and how often do we want to repeat these tests? Once you have a normal cholesterol, when should you get your next cholesterol test? You know, I like to say every 5 years, unless something else goes on. But there may be doctors who say more frequently. There may be doctors who say less frequently.
Could you mention again the things that can be looked at in a cholesterol test?
Well, cholesterol itself, you can test for the low-density cholesterol, the high-density cholesterol, and the very low-density cholesterol. Now, there is particle size testing, too, and that's even newer and probably mostly done in research settings. And then you can look at the apolipoproteins that go along with cholesterol. Now, with there are other blood fats, and triglycerides, particularly in women, are another blood fat that would have to be tested. It's usually in what's called a lipid profile, but if you get a simple cholesterol test, you're not going to get a triglyceride level.
So a lipid.
Right. A lipid profile would probably tease out more of these kinds of things. And then there are tests that are not at all related to blood fats, but seem to be related to heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
And those were some of the other tests we were talking about.
Could you mention them again?
Well, for instance, cardio C-reactive protein is a measure of inflammation. And
cardio C refractor?
Yeah, well, you might just put C-CRP. A doctor would know what that is. But C-reactive protein.
Okay.
And you can get a regular CRP, which isn't the right test. So you want to be sure you get the right test.
C-CRP.
Correct. And then a homocysteine level, which is really a measure of the folic acid level either in your body or in your diet.
And how does that affect women in heart disease, the folic acid test?
Well, we think that that the metabolism of folic acid has to do with whether or not you're going to – all these things actually have to do with whether or not you're going to build up blockages in important arteries. And it is a multi-step process that involves literally hundreds of different molecules and different aspects of health. So, for instance, one of the things that can pile up and block a blood vessel might be, for instance, platelets. And that's why taking an aspirin can actually help, because aspirin is a little bit antiplatelet. Also, aspirins can help decrease inflammation. So one of the treatments for an elevated cardio C-reactive protein is to take daily aspirin doses.
Okay. And to test the inflammation, again, it's a blood test.
Yes.
And you're testing the inflammation of the artery?
It's a more nonspecific test than that, but it is correlated with the overall levels of inflammation in your body.
Overall levels of inflammation. And again, it's just a blood test.
Yes.
Ah, okay. Well, you are just a gold mine of information. And
well, it's a very complicated topic, and I know that we have some cardiologists that occasionally visit and could probably go on and on about all the nuances of these tests and the risks and benefits of taking them.
Okay.
It's not clear cut for every individual.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She's on the program each month, always on a Monday. We talk about women's health. And your questions are welcome. We have another person here who's ready, and we'll get right to them. The phone number, though, if you'd like to call us, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Aurora. Line number 4. Hello.
Yes. Hi. Good morning. Mm-hmm. My daughter is a rheumatology nurse and works with fibromyalgia patients. And yesterday she brought me some booklets, and I'd like to read that fibromyalgia is a chronic, non-articular rheumatic condition more often affecting women than men, that is linked to a syndrome popularly referred to as fibrofog. I guess I'm reading this to speak to any people, any women that might be listening, and to give the information about fibromyalgia, and also at this date, to say that now there is a support group. It's a woman in Antioch, Illinois, started it, and it's called AFTER, AFFTER, Advocates for Fibromyalgia Funding, Treatment, Education, and Research. It is a nonprofit organization run by volunteers, most of whom have fibromyalgia. And I thought that these women that have it in the audience might want to know that finally there is available a program for them, a support program. And I will give the number, the phone number, if I might.
Sure.
If they want the post office box also. It's AFTER, AFFTER, Post Office Box 4262, Antioch, Illinois. Zip is 60002. And the phone number is 847-395-595-5123. There also is a fax number, 847-395-5272. That's the fax number. I just give this information because I had a woman working for me with fibromyalgia, and I know that it is a very, very painful disease with no... At this time, there doesn't seem to be a cure or a knowledge of what causes it, although it does come after a traumatic incident in their lives. If you want to speak to any more about this, I'll hang up and let you. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks for the information.
Well, fibromyalgia certainly is a perplexing illness, and we think that it may be one of the diseases that's related to what's called, has been also called chronic fatigue syndrome. And there's been a lot of talk that, in fact, some of these conditions are related to viruses, as we were talking earlier, that viruses may be the ultimate cause of many conditions we haven't traditionally thought to be infectious per se. And it is true that there's been a tremendous amount of work, and it's a relatively newly characterized disease, but ultimately we don't know exactly how to make the diagnosis nor how to treat many patients. It's not completely disabling for all women, yet that for some individuals it can be severely disabling. So there seems to be a spectrum. There have been reported cases that do spontaneously resolve over time, so that's encouraging to some individuals. Many individuals have effectively been treated by psychological counseling and medications for treatment of antidepressants, but it's not really known whether that addressed the disease problem or some of the sequelae or the consequences of the disease problem. There was a review article about it in, I think, one of the lead sections of the journal for the AMA, JAMA, in the past 6 months to a year. I remember reading it, but I can't remember exactly when it was, that went over very briefly but succinctly what's known and not known about it. So probably searching through the medical libraries for some of those old copies, you could probably find additional information.
Okay. We'll try to get one more person here in Mahomet, line one. Hello.
Hello. Good morning, doctor. Since your specialty is OBGYN, I'd like to ask you a question specifically related to that. After a woman has had a complete hysterectomy, what information would you recommend, like for periodic pelvic exams? What kind of testing? I mean, assuming that she's, you know, taking HR hormone therapy. I mean, and what is the benefit of a pelvic exam if basically, you know, everything has been removed? If you could comment on that, please, and I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Okay.
Well, most patients, when they're referring to a complete hysterectomy, mean that the entire uterus, including its cervix, was removed as well as the ovaries. Now, there are, of course, many variations, and depending on what the condition was that caused the surgery, there may be other aspects to the surgery that the individual patient may have had that would impact on her future care. There's no doubt that pelvic examinations can help assess a number of things. They help to assess the health of the vulva, the health of the vagina. By manual examination, they can help assess pelvic support structure and function as well. So I think all of that is extremely important. We think that the vagina can undergo some of the same changes, precancerous type changes that we were talking about earlier with the cervix. We know that it's a little bit less likely and they progress much more slowly. So the current recommendations have been backing off on how frequent to recommend pap smears, whereas some physicians still did yearly pap smears to detect these changes. Many physicians have moved to doing those pap smears every 2 to 3 years, and some physicians even less frequently than that. And probably to decide exactly how often you need a pap smear, you need to sit down with your physician after your hysterectomy and get his or her opinion specifically about your case.
There we will have to leave it because we're here at the end of the time. We want to say to Dr. Trubin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For being here. And she will be back here again next month. She's here each month, and we do these programs on women's health. Suzanne Trubin is professor of obstetrics and gynecology at U of I College of Medicine and also has practice here in our area.